we species, human race, are always thinking that we are at the center of the universe, but we are not.
Hello.
Your life is simply a human life.
Neville Coghill, as we know, translated Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
Yeah, my parents don't read my poems at all. I think this was the first.
I'm not really a pizza lover, but now and again I'd like one with anchovies and sausage or something.
See it that way. I don't really believe in character. I believe in moments of truth, and a moment of truth is.
The Paris Review Podcast, Episode 20. A Gift for Burning, featuring an essay by Molly McCulley Brown, a short story by Venita Blackburn, a poem by Monica Yoon, and we begin with excerpts from the Paris Review's 2019 interview with George Saunders.
I've read that you worked in your dad's restaurants, which were called Chicken Unlimited. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering what they were like. Like, what was Chicken Unlimited like, and what was it like to work there?
Well, it was a franchise restaurant that was just starting up. So the two of them that we owned were identical on the inside. They come out and they would build it for you, you know. I guess it was supposed to be kind of a competitor to Kentucky Fried Chicken. But we had this really zen motto. It was Chicken Unlimited doesn't stop at chicken. Right. Well, so it was fun. It was my whole family worked in there. Most of my high school friends worked in there. So after school, you just scoot over there and the place would be full of people that you knew and loved. And I was a delivery boy. So mostly I just come from school, never did a lick of homework, just get in the van and start delivering. We had CB radios then when we had to come back and pick up deliveries. So, you know, 16 years old, just with your license and get in the car, get on the radio and just drive around all night, you know. And that beautiful experience of, like, in a night, getting to stand in 20 houses or, you know, mostly they'd invite you in. And, you know, people didn't really clean up their shit before you came in. So you'd step into a house and you're like, wow, this is, you know, very novelistic. Remember, there's this one woman who lived right in this apartment complex behind the store. So she'd come in and she'd stay for 5 and 6 hours at a time, and she'd be talking to herself, very, very manic. She chain smoked and she drank big Pepsis, 6 or 7 in a row, you know. Then she'd go home and call sometimes 3 or 4 deliveries a night. And we got paid for every one, so it was fine, but you'd go over there, not a bit of furniture in the house, just ashtrays and Pepsi cups, and the order would be a pack of Camels and a Pepsi. And you'd go over, and so you just step into that intense loneliness, and you could feel it, you know. And you could see that she was embarrassed to be in that position, and there was a discomfort of being a young person in her house and looking around and seeing that it was inadequate. But the beauty was you had basically a relationship with her, because I saw her every day from my junior year of high school, pretty much, you know.
We've seen claims that Twinkies aren't baked, the sponge cake instead being a pure chemical reaction involving something that foams up. The deception is made complete by coloring the confection's bottoms brown to make it appear that they've been baked. As always, the truth is far less exciting than the lore. Epigraph from Snopes.com.
All right, so this poem is based on this urban legend that was current in my junior high school that Twinkies, the baked good, aren't actually baked, that they were like this goo that was extruded and then exposed to a chemical catalyst so that they foamed up and grew this kind of foamy golden outer layer on top of this like white gooey inner layer. And this is what I believed for decades until I came around to researching this poem. Twinkie also is an epithet for people who are yellow on the outside and white on the inside. And this was just kind of what people thought about Twinkies. Goldacre by Monica Yoon. As if you were ever wide-eyed enough to believe in urban legends. As if these plot elements weren't the stalest of cliches, the secret lab, the anaerobic chamber, the gloved hand ex machina, the chemical-infused fog. As if every origin story didn't center on the same sweet myth of a lost wholeness. As if such longing would seem more palatable if packaged as nostalgia. As if there had once been an instant of unity, smoothly numinous, pellucid. As if inner and outer were merely phases of the same substance. As if this whiteness had been your original condition. As if it hadn't been what was piped into you, what suffused each vacant cell, each air hole, each pore, as if you had started out skinless, shameless, blameless, creamy, as if whipped, passive, as if extruded, quivering with volatility in a metal mold. As if a catalyzing vapor triggered a latent reaction, as if your flesh foamed up, a hydrogenated emulsion consisting mostly of trapped air. As if, though sponge-like, you could remain shelf-stable for decades, part embalming fluid, part rocket fuel, part glue. As if, instead, you had been named twin, a word for likeness, or wink, a word for joke, or ink, a word for stain, or key, a word for answer. As if your skin oxidized to its present burnished hue, golden, as if homemade.
I just remember being on the bus coming home from work, and our kids were little, having my little 10-point font manuscript and a pen, and just going into this great concentrative zone. And it was just one of the first times I discovered that I could really make a story by fragments. In other words, I didn't have to have a through line, didn't have to know where it was going. I could basically write a paragraph a day and then micro-examine it for the next day or so. And that feeling, that beautiful feeling that if I could have 40 minutes on the way home and not get distracted, I could make a genuine difference in that text. And that if I did it, then plot would get made.
Right.
But it was liberating because I had been told by others and by myself that you could not write a book while you were working full time because there was no time for concentration. And I was finding out that for me, anyway, concentration was available. And it was also valuable, even in small doses. That was like, whoa, I can do this, you know.
After the break, fiction from Benita Blackburn, more from George Saunders, and an essay by Molly McCulley Brown, when the Paris Review podcast continues.
If You Are Permanently Lost, an essay by Molly McCulley Brown. I never have any idea where I am. I lived my whole childhood in the purple foothills of the same 5-square-mile town, and I still couldn't tell you whether to turn left or right on the single throughway to get to the grocery store, or how to find the houses of my childhood friends. I can't tell you how to find the conspicuously modern angles of the apartment building in the small Mississippi town where I lived for 3 years in graduate school, or even easily direct you from my old house in Austin to the bright little bar where I wrote much of my first book. Even though it's less than half a mile from my current apartment in London, I couldn't get to the Thames without the artificial voice on my cell phone calling out, "Turn left," every 250 feet. Half the time, to remember which way is left, I have to imagine for an instant that I am picking up a pen. Even on a much smaller scale, space makes no sense to me. I walk all the way around the perimeter of a room to reach a door that's immediately to my right. And I set my glass down half an inch from the edge of the table with such frequency that anyone who knows me well gets used to nudging it back again and again over the course of an evening. As a girl, I put my shoes on the wrong feet so reliably that my parents directed me just to behave in defiance of my inclinations. If I thought a sneaker should go on one foot, put it on the other. I do come to recognize landmarks. Pale blue awning of the nearest dry cleaners, wrought iron railing along the railroad bridge, surprise of a green painted storefront among all the brick, which is how I navigate some frequent paths of travel. But no collection of spaces, no matter how habitually I move through them, ever knits into any kind of coherent map inside my head. I'll be wandering in the city, convinced I'm miles away from anywhere I've ever been, and then turn a corner to see the shapes of my own block rising up as if transplanted. Their familiarity more unsettling than encountering something new. Proof I lack a homing instinct of any kind. There's a neurological explanation for at least some of this. The ability to process information about distance, angles, and direction is called spatial cognition. And the oxygen deprivation at birth that caused my cerebral palsy resulted in some injury to the neural structures that make this kind of reasoning possible. Even beyond the oxygen deprivation, though, it turns out that spatial cognition begins to develop in young children concurrently with what professionals term independent locomotion, the ability to get around under your own steam. Essentially, you gain the capacity to map the world as you begin to move intentionally through it, the brain wiring in sync with what the body does. I never wiggled or crawled effectively, my muscles too spastic and stiff, and I didn't learn to walk until too late for the typical cognitive progress to occur. There's an allotted developmental window for the needed synchronicity to come to pass. And if it doesn't, it's impossible to perfectly correct the disjunction. With attention, you can create some new neural pathways, alternate routes to comprehending space. But you can't retrace the steps you should have taken. For a long time, my lack of spatial awareness mostly felt like an inconvenience, minor in comparison with my difficulty walking or my chronic pain. But I've been thinking lately about home and navigation, what it means to be perennially dislocated, what it means when space refuses to coalesce into a place you know. Marbled newts, displaced from their breeding pools, can find their way back home only when certain stars are visible. They spend whole days paused with their bellies pressed to the ground, waiting for the sun to set, the clouds to clear. Homing pigeons' compass mechanisms rely on the sun. But when it's dark or clouded over, they can feel the Earth's magnetic field. Iron particles collected in their beaks will always tug them toward true north. Honeybees navigate by polarized light. Bats and cave swiftlets and porpoises map intricate and perfect distances from echoes. And even some mollusks, base and faceless, are thought to hold a topographic memory of the land, finding their way via familiar contours, the rises and gullies they remember how to fit inside. All these bodies that know home somewhere inside them. It isn't at all that I don't get attached to landscapes. There's a scent of Virginia magnolia, dusk sweet and too much, that I can call up instantly. And my favorite sound is the particular loud, humid crack of a weirdly rainless southern thunderstorm come out of nowhere and then gone again. But you could put me down on the land I love most in the world, and I would still be lost inside it. I've lived in 6 different cities and towns in the past 10 years, and now 2 foreign countries in the past 6 months. Without really meaning to, I've made a life where it's reasonable to never know my way around. I'm new, I say, or I'm about to go, or I don't live here. I'm just visiting. I think, this isn't my real life. At a medical library in London, I stand in front of a photographic print of the human brain and spinal column, strung with nerves, magnified to many times its size. It looks, more than anything, like a raft someone assembled swiftly, in a panic, trying to survive a storm. I keep thinking of the last stanza of that Adrian Rich poem, Song. If I'm lonely, it's with the rowboat ice fast on the shore, in the last red light of the year, that knows what it is, knows it's neither ice nor mud nor winter light, but wood with a gift for burning. If there's any territory I should know well, it's the country of my own body. So much of my life has been devoted to attending to its tenuous center of gravity, the tense curl of my hamstrings and heel cords, the banks of calluses along the perimeters of my feet, hardened from years of walking on my toes with my feet listing stubbornly to one side, the fading ridgeline where they sliced me open at the spine. I've had so many cartographers and architects, doctor's appointments and surgeries designed to map my body, alter its geography, to make it more habitable. It, at least, should be comprehensible. Place instead of merely space. But because the world refuses to grow knowable and navigable, because my brain cannot compose a cogent map, my body is rendered new to me each time I try to move through space. And because my body itself has been reshaped so many times, both through the intentional, artificial manipulations of surgery and by its own ongoing and present disintegration, I can't truly know or trust its geography either. The tectonic plates of who I am are always shifting. My friend Susanna has also had a great deal of surgery, her own profound erosions. This heavy grief, finally shared with another person, yielded a nearly instant bond between us. We both know that the moment that your body sutures together into a whole and steady place you know, something will give way, and you'll be changed to mere parts again. Sometimes I think I've made myself into a constant traveler as a defense mechanism. On a practical level, it's a bad strategy. But in another way, it makes a kind of sense. I'd rather be a stranger because of something I decided than as a consequence of something in me. Some lack that proves again and again just how damaged an animal I am. Constant motion camouflages the extent to which I'm alien, even to myself. Again and again, I return to Rich's rowboat, beached on the cold shore. I think, I don't know where or what I am. But then I consider how Rich transfigures it again and again over the course of a single line. Boat to ice, to mud, to winter light, and finally to wood, raw material whose most miraculous property is its ability to burn, break down, change. The woman in Rich's song drives continually onward, leaves behind mile after mile little towns she might have stopped and lived and died in. But the poem itself holds all those possible lives at once. The fragment is rendered its own small, self-contained place, its capacity for continual transformation a gift of metaphor, music, and line. To work your way forward when you are permanently lost means, yes, to be exhausted and adrift, a stranger in a strange land. But as a writer, it also means living in a state of endless discovery. The world unfurls itself anew each day with dawn's first cold breath on the city. You re-encounter what you are, lonely like a body with a gift for burning.
Feel that I was on the brink of a breakthrough, and it had something to do with, you know, abandoning my constructed ideas about what I was doing, abandoning fucking Hemingway once and for all, you know.
Right.
It also had to do with abandoning my I had a tendency to be kind of a young old man, to be controlling, to be a little bit judgmental, a weird tendency to not like anything new. Mm-hmm. So when I had this breakthrough, it was kind of like saying, look, man, I understand that that's part of your personality, but also part of your personality is you played in rock bands and you've been quite decadent since you turned 23. Let that in. Let newness in. I think one of the things I used to resist, and I resisted this in Slaughterhouse-Five the first time I read it, I thought that the best writing was just true. It was just you going out in the world and reporting back in, you know, simple objective sentences, and I really like that idea. So when I would read a book where there was clearly some riffing going on, you know, like Slaughterhouse-Five, where there's time travel, that little, prick that I was didn't like that somehow. And now I liked it in movies and I liked it in songs, but in literature I just wanted it to be very simple and truthful. And it was the first time it occurred to me that when you break that veil of reality, you're doing it for emotional reasons, and therefore you are a realist. You're being an emotional realist, because the actual range of emotions we feel in this contemporary world are kind of crazy. If you wanted to tell an emotional truth about the way we actually live, you might have to violate reality.
Thank you. Sam, a short story by Vanita Blackburn. My little sister, niece, granddaughter, baby cousin doesn't know she's pretty, so she asks everybody, one post at a time. Her mom showed up at her high school graduation. No one had seen her in 8 years. Mothers like that never know how to dress. Too much fake jewelry, fake hair, and a big-ass fake leather purse, still too small for all her shame and addictions to everything else. My little sister, niece, granddaughter, baby cousin went to a costume party dressed as Selena or Madonna or Paula Abdul, just a thin layer of 1985 draped over her tits. She works out a lot. A pic for the shoulder press, 78 likes. A pic for the deadlifts, 134 likes. Don't get me started on the squats. She doesn't like photos of her when she isn't ready, when her face is the one we see in the mornings, when she can't find her keys, or when her phone is silent and black and asleep and dead, and she has to wait fidgeting in that space so close to oblivion. They put titanium rods in her back when she was 11 to correct the scoliosis. She used to walk around like a black Quasimodo, loved and gorgeous. The metal worked to undo the snake spine, only a little pain and constipation from the meds to whip her back straight. Afterward, there came new clothes, new friends, new hobbies, one after another on a conveyor belt, along with the chance to document it all. Her happiness was electric, blinking, a ding, 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 ding. Disappointment is oily. It has hair and musk and cracked lipstick. Her mother never spoke at the graduation, just faded away into the crowd per the court order. They say scoliosis is common in obese girls. The weight on their bird-like skeletons is too much. My little sister, niece, granddaughter, baby cousin was popular. 117 hearts for feeding ice cream to a puppy. 64 LOLs for flipping off the president. 216 likes for a poolside bikini pose at sunset. There are never enough. Of course the monsters came, the trolls with their emoji fangs shooting projectile venom of envy and disgust. We were afraid she would choke to death on the poison like the white girls on TV, hang from closet doors, bleed out into tubs. But my little sister, niece, granddaughter, baby cousin never even said a fuck you, just kept on. When your mother punches you in the chest for reasons too small to see, the rest of the world has a hard time hurting you more. So she smiles into her phone, or smiles the brightest, into the light, the wires, the electricity of us, who have become everything to her. Because in the machine there is no blood, no bone, and no fat.
Do you think you'd be a different writer if you hadn't had children?
I don't think I would have published anything, actually. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I know when we did have our kids, I was really at kind of an artistic dead end. I was a good person and kind of moderate person, but nothing seemed morally charged to me. I thought, well, yeah, you know, you could do whatever you like. It doesn't really matter. If somebody was a druggie, it's fine. If somebody's decadent, whatever, I don't care. It doesn't matter. So then when I went to write stories, I didn't really know what I believed in. I didn't really, I kind of thought everything was pretty good, you know? And then when we had our kids, suddenly it was, the world got morally infused overnight because just of that simple thing. Like if I treasure this little person this much and my wife, then suddenly you look up and everybody's somebody's beloved or should be. The world is full of meaning. And then what happened was, instead of writing stories about people in war who pillaged entire villages, it was just a guy at work or you know, some small thing. So in other words, if somebody is beloved to anybody, then anything that happens to that person is story.
Concludes the Paris Review podcast, episode 20, A Gift for Burning. The pieces you heard in this episode are excerpts from our 2019 Art of Fiction interview with George Saunders. He was interviewed by Benjamin Nugent. Goldacre, a poem written and read by
Monica Yoon.
If You Are Permanently Lost, an essay read for us by the author
Molly McCulley Brown.
You also heard Fam, a short story written and read for us by the author
Vanita Blackburn.
The Singing Girl in the Bathtub is courtesy of Anna Bloom. This podcast is a co-production of the Paris Review and Stitcher. Our production team includes John Delore, Brendan Francis Newnham, Craig Morgan Teicher, and Laurie Dorr. Our senior producer is Helena de Groot. Executive producers are Daisy Rosario, Peter Clowney, and me, Emily Stokes. This episode was mixed and sound designed by Helena de Groot. Our podcast features original music composed and performed by a talented ensemble that includes David Sieri, Emily Wells, Mike Brown, Sam Ospovot, Rob Schwimmer, Shazad Ismaili, and Casey Holford. Our theme song is composed by David Sieri. A very special thanks to the Morgan Library and Museum, home of the archive of the Paris Review. As always, if you want to read any of the pieces in this episode, subscribe at theparisreview.org. You'll get access to our full digital archive and 4 print issues featuring the very best in new poetry, prose, and interviews. I'm Emily Stokes, editor of the Paris Review. Thanks for listening. Until next time. Stitcher.